This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. Here is an important question. Is conservatism in 21st century America a lost cause, or is there a way forward that we need to freshly consider? We're going to talk about it today with Rita Dunaway. She is a constitutional attorney and serves as the National Legislative Strategist for the Convention of States Project, and we'll be talking about her book called Restoring America's Soul, Advancing Timeless Conservative Principles in a Wayward Culture. Rita, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I appreciate your being with us. This is really a subject close to my heart, and I think this is so important. You make this comment at the beginning of your book about what conservatism is at its core, which I think was really well said. You say it's the effort to champion virtue and to conserve goodness, truth, and beauty generally and in particular. How would you evaluate how we're doing on that score as conservatives right now?
Oh, dear. I think we have so much room for improvement.
Yes.
We have a lot of work to do on that. And that was really one of the main reasons I decided to write the book, because I think even in the way we talk about what a conservative is, we tend to talk about what we don't want. We tend to talk about the government policies that we oppose. But in its truest sense, a conservative is someone who's seeking to conserve the things we hope to keep in our culture and in our government. And so I just think we have a long way to go. We have a lot to learn to get back to describing ourselves and our worldview really in a positive way. And that's especially important when we think about appealing to younger people in our society today. They don't want to be part of a movement that's opposed to a bunch of things. They want to be part of a movement that is for things.
Yes, that's so true. And I saw recently this poll. There have been several polls, actually, that have come out about the millennials and the Generation Z being in favor of socialism. You see how Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has become this rock star of the Democratic Party. And yet every idea coming out of her mouth, from my perspective, is idiotic. I mean, she, you know, I'm not trying to be mean. I'm just saying the Green New Deal is ridiculous. Socialism is ridiculous. It's a failed policy all across the world. And yet these younger, you know, students and young adults are looking at this and saying, wow, that's awesome. What has happened that in the United States, we now have upcoming generations thinking socialism is the bee's knees? What's going on here?
You know, I think that is such a great example of what's happened in this country. So I'm glad that you brought up that issue of socialism. It is an empty promise. And so I think what we have to do as conservatives is we certainly need to point out how and why socialism is an empty promise. And then we need to point to our positive vision. So, you know, first of all, socialism is immoral. You know, when we're talking about the government taking from the wealthy just to for the purpose of redistributing wealth and giving wealth to other people, that's plunder.
Yes,
you know, it's just a form of theft and stealing. That's not a legitimate role of government, certainly not in America. But then the other problem with socialism is that, and the reason I say it's an empty promise is because so many people think if we just, you know, give people more money, more material resources, that will somehow cure the ills of society. And that just doesn't work. And I would point all the way back to 1966 with James Coleman's report on education, which came to be known as the Coleman Report. Everyone thought that this study, where they looked at just mountains of data and research, everyone thought it was going to show that the way to get better schools, the way to get better outcomes from schools would be to dump more money into the schools. And what this report proved is that the primary predictor of student success was the quality of those students' families. That is not something the government can fix by throwing money at it. So socialism is an empty promise. We need to point that out. But then we need to explain, you know, conservatives care about the poor. We care deeply about the poor and the condition and situation for individuals and for families.
Yes.
But our vision is for a nation where we care for the poor in our communities, where families take care of families, where churches take care of the needs among their members, and where private organizations use innovation and ingenuity to work out solutions to care for the people around them. That is the way we envision caring for people. It's people caring for people.
Right. That's so right. What do you make, though, of the climate in which we're all operating? And what I mean by that is, as somebody once said, are we having a debate while they're having a war? In other words, they're always coming up with these new progressive utopian visions on the left, and the right is scrambling a little bit to say, "What? No, wait." And we're always on the defense, as you mentioned. Why do you think there is something fundamentally flawed about the way we're going about fighting the fight? Is there a problem there, do you think?
Well, I think what we're seeing is sort of a natural consequence of the fact that the ideology of conservatives or our worldview does have to do with limited government. That is, after all, the type of government we were given in the Constitution. And so I think it's really easy for the conservative worldview to come across as, oh, we just want to be left alone.
Yes.
And I think we have to work really hard, as I was saying before, through presenting a positive alternative to big government programs that show that, yeah, we want to care for people, too. We want what's best for people. But what's best for people is local help. Communities helping their own, families and churches helping their own.
Right.
So I think that's something we have to get a lot better at doing, for sure.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you there. And yet it's hard because you look at these statistics, this socialism poll that just recently came out from Harris. One of the things that was so ironic about it is you had 67% of millennials in Generation Z saying, we believe that high earnings come about because of free enterprise, but the same number of them wanted to have free college tuition, government given free tuition, and they wanted to have free government health care. And I thought, this doesn't even go together. What in the world are you thinking? You can't have those things simultaneously. But how do you fight that, you know, the lust for free stuff? I mean, how can conservatives compete with that? We can't. I mean, in some sense of the term.
Yeah, I think part of what is missing has to do with the way we educate young people about government. And, you know, I don't know if we can get the government schools to do a better job with this. And so we, as, you know, members of the conservative movement, or as Christians even, need to do a really good job of teaching our kids and, you know, all the young people we come into contact with, that there is a legitimate role of government, and it is limited. You know, the government was never meant, neither biblically speaking, you know, if you look at what God's word says about government, and certainly if you look at our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, government was never meant to be a provider of goodies for the people.
Right.
That was never meant to be its role, because if you have a government that does that, you have a government that is going to usurp every ounce of freedom and liberty of the people.
Oh,
the
sure.
government was meant to protect the people's lives, our rights, and to keep us safe, and to do jobs that only government can do.
Oh, yeah. Obviously, it's a genius way of constructing a constitutional republic. The challenge for us is being able to educate, as you mentioned, the next generation, so yeah. they will carry it on. We're going to take a break. Yeah. We'll come back with Rita Dunaway. Her book is called Restoring America's Soul, and you're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Stay with us.
From Thinking Man Films and Fathom Events comes Patterns of Evidence, The Moses Controversy. A new documentary follows investigative filmmaker Timothy Mahoney's faith-affirming journey throughout the Middle East in search of scientific evidence that Moses wrote the first books of the Bible.
The Lord said to Moses, write this in a book.
Patterns of Evidence, The Moses Controversy. In theaters March 19th only. More information is available at patternsofevidence.com/Moses.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
If you're a medical professional, here's a way to move from success to even greater significance. Mercy Ships has an urgent need for pediatric registered nurses. You'll be joining dozens of volunteer medical professionals who've been blessed by the opportunity.
I think all nurses should do something like this. To serve the unserved is one of the most beautiful experiences.
Get more information by visiting mercyships.org/nurses. Mercy Ships, bringing hope and healing to the world's forgotten poor.
We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Thanks for joining us, and we're excited to have with us Rita Dunaway. She is a constitutional attorney and serves as the National Legislative Strategist for the Convention of States Project. She is also the author of Restoring America's Soul, which we've been discussing. Such a fascinating discussion. Rita, when we talk about the things that we hope to keep, you use that phrase in the book and reference this in one of your early chapters. We are, as conservatives, conservers of the things we hope to keep. One of the things that Christians have noticed with great alarm recently is losing religious liberty, losing our ability to live out our faith in Jesus Christ in this society without coming up against activists who are offended at the very concept of religious liberty, who are not probably religious at all. What do we do about this? I mean, there are so many people flailing now and saying, how do we, we're in new uncharted waters. What do we even do here?
Yeah, it's not an easy fix because essentially religious liberty, which, as we know, is the first liberty protected in the Bill of Rights because it was so just fundamental to the whole concept of people being free. It's been set on a collision course with this whole realm of sexual liberties, yep. if you will.
Yep.
And, you know, it's really unfortunate. I talk about in the book, my experience having worked before I came to Convention of States, I worked for the Rutherford Institute. And so I dealt with a lot of religious liberties cases. And back then, you know, even 10 years ago, it seemed like most of the cases that we would see having to do with religious liberty were really about the Establishment Clause, you know, what some people refer to as the separation of church and state. We would have all these cases about, you know, can a second grade student hand out pencils with Bible verses on them in class, or can we have a Ten Commandments monument at a courthouse or somewhere in public? And, you know, those are all important issues. They were important issues for us to deal with, but it's really shocking to see how the front in religious liberty has shifted to now what we are being forced to fight over in the courts is whether a person can be compelled by force of law to actually enter into the service of an act that violates their sincerely held religious belief.
Yes.
And I'm talking, of course, about, you know, Jack Phillips, the baker.
Right.
We see florists and photographers who are, you know, being pressed into service of a cause that is antithetical to what their faith teaches them is right and good and true. And so it's absolutely alarming. We need to hope and pray for the justices of the Supreme Court that they will be a bastion of protection for religious liberty, and that they will have an opportunity to set some good groundbreaking precedents that go much further than what we have now in protecting rights of conscience and religious freedom.
Oh, you are so on the money about that. I mean, that's exactly what has been going on. That's the direction of the drift. And it's so scary because you have all of these liberals now, and they have a lot of support from corporations that are, you know, sped on by groups like the Human Rights Campaign, the homosexual rights lobby group, biggest one in the world, onto this Equality Act. And the Equality Act, I'm not a lawyer, you are, but the Equality Act, in my mind, some have called it the Criminalization of Christianity Act. It basically is an attack on free exercise. And this is exactly what the First Amendment prohibits. And yet you have this wide swath of politicians and activists who want to pass this thing. And I'm not even sure Christians understand how dangerous this really is.
Yeah, it's incredibly dangerous. And, you know, I think it's so interesting if you look back a few years ago to when this whole saga of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act played out in the state of Indiana.
Yes.
When Mike Pence was governor there. And, of course, the whole, you know, homosexual activists groups just descended upon that. The state of Indiana became public enemy number one because of this law, which, you know, what people didn't understand, because what those activists didn't explain, was that all that law would have done would be to require a balancing of the interests of people whose religious faith conflicted with something the law seemed to be requiring them to do. They would balance the religious liberty interests against the interests that were being served by whatever law that is.
Right.
I mean, what more reasonable policy can you have than that? And yet that was hailed by these activists as, you know, giving people freedom to discriminate against gay people, which,
no,
of course, it did nothing of the sort. And now what we see is a push to basically do the reverse.
Yes.
And it's so troubling and disturbing. Yes, Christians need to absolutely be aware of that.
Yeah, and it drives me crazy because they have this narrative they're pushing, that guy Pete Buttigieg, who is the Democratic hopeful for president in 2020, who's been going around and talking about his candidacy. He's quote unquote married to a man. He's a homosexual South Bend mayor. He is talking about what happened during the RFRA fight in Indiana. Oh, we all came together. It was a very reasonable coalition. We're on the right side of history. And Pence was a hater. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, OK, that's not what happened, because, you know,
no.
I was there. I covered it at the time. And in fact, what Pence set out to do, and I appreciate Vice President Pence very much, but what Pence set out to do, he actually ended up doing the opposite because of all the pressure that he got from gay activists. Let's not rewrite history here. That's what happened.
Yes, that it is unfortunate. And I talk about that whole situation in the book as an example of how, you know, the left, and you mentioned this earlier, the left is really out to win this war. And unfortunately, what conservatives tend to do is that because we hate being called haters and we hate being called homophobes, because it's not who we are, it's really incorrect about us, but that's so alarming to us when we hear those allegations that we tend to quickly kind of pack up our tent and go home.
Yes.
And back out of the fight instead of standing and saying, no, that's not what's true about this law. Here is what this law would actually do. And this is good and right. And this is totally consistent with the values of America. And so I am going to stand here. I'm going to take my stand because this is good and right.
Right. I agree with you there. And it's, you know, that it's a very effective kind of Alinsky-esque tactic, is you just freeze people and polarize them and neutralize them, yeah. marginalize them. I mean, because it understands human nature. People don't like being called names. They don't want to be insulted. They don't want to be looked upon with any disdain. We got to get over that, though, because we're really coming toward a point of no return. And this is kind of the whole thrust of your book about restoring America's soul. What do you think is the way back? I know there are so many moving parts when you consider this question, but what would you advise Christians and conservatives to begin to do to restore America's soul as a whole and to make a difference in our culture?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, we have to engage more, not less, in culture and in our politics. You know, there's a tendency to get discouraged and frustrated, and so we just kind of want to retreat into the safety and comfort of our homes and our churches. But we have to stay engaged because, look, we're carrying a banner of truth. It is our job to be faithful and obedient in carrying that banner in a very dark world, in a very dark culture. And we have to continue to do that come what may.
Yeah.
I would also say we need to raise our standards, not lower them. We're too easily satisfied when we should be pointing ever higher. We should be looking for candidates who are, you know, honorable and who are faithful people. We have to articulate a positive vision for America and not just talk about the things that we oppose. And we have to do it in a gracious and winsome way, not in a sarcastic or biting or snarky way, but we have to be winsome. And then as far as specifics, you know, I lay out a two-track solution in the book. And the first track has to do with culture and being engaged with that. That has to start at home. You know, yes. We have to train our own children. And it's not easy because of what we face in the world today. But we have to train our kids to know and understand what they believe and to be able to stand up for it in a way that is logical, persuasive, and winsome. And then secondly, when it comes to restoring our government, and particularly our federal government, which now is acting far beyond the bounds of its constitutional authority, I point people toward the Convention of States.
Yes.
Process.
Yes, yes. Where can people find out more information about that? Because that's really an important thing for everybody to know about.
Yeah, I would encourage everybody to visit conventionofstates.com, and you can learn all about it. You can read about it or watch videos if that's, you know, preferable to you. But it's a really important protection that our founding fathers gave us right in the Constitution, so that we as people in the states would have a way to come together and collectively rein in a federal government that has gotten out of control and gone outside of its constitutional box.
That's right. Well, people can check it out, as you've mentioned, at conventionofstates.com. And the name of the book, again, is Restoring America's Soul. Rita Dunaway, our guest. And so good to have you here, Rita. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. God bless you. And we'll be back on Janet Meffer Today right after this. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmeffer.com. We are back on Janet Mefford today. Texas Values is a great group, a pro-family group in the state of Texas where I reside, and they had a recent Faith and Family Day 2019. It was held at the Texas State Capitol in Austin, and one of the people they had speak at this Faith and Family Day was a man named Jeff Younger. I don't know if you know that name. A lot of people have been writing about him last fall. His story was in the Christian Post and the Federalist and LifeSite News and a number of other outlets because of what is going on with his little boy. It is such a difficult story to listen to, but I thought that his story was so compelling that it would be worth sharing it with you. Now, he's speaking outside into a microphone, so it's a little more echoey than it would be if he were inside a building. So just take that into account. But I want you to hear a little bit about Jeff's story. This is Cut One.
6 years and 10 months ago, the good Lord gave me two sons. I named them James and Jude after the brothers of Jesus. They were baptized and dedicated to a life of Christ. My ex-wife divorced me. She got primary custody of the children. And starting around the age of two, she began saying that James was really a girl. My son started telling me that he had a girl's brain in a boy's body. When he got older, I was registered my son James in school, in the Capel School District, Pinkerton Elementary. He's known there by a fake girl named Luna. He uses the girl's bathroom. He wears a dress. All of his authority figures telling me he's a girl, except me. Yet James has never, not once, ever, come to me and presented it to himself as a girl. He's always a boy with me. He's a normal roughhousing boy. In fact, his favorite activity is wrestling and boxing, and he's a darn good boxer, I'll tell you that.
Okay, this is a little strange, isn't it? So you have a situation with divorced parents. The father says that the wife declared this little two-year-old boy had the brain of a girl and now goes by the name Luna and wears dresses to school. And yet he never, according to his father, he never has presented as anything but a boy to his dad, which is quite interesting. Then he goes on to talk about his son being enrolled in a clinic that does sex change operations. This is incredible. Listen to Cut Two.
Also enrolled James when he was 5 years old into a clinic, the Genesis Clinic. And they do sex change operations on children in Dallas, Texas. I see some of you don't believe that. Get your phones out. G-E-N-E-C-I-S Clinic in Dallas, Texas. And you'll see pictures of children they have done sex change surgeries on. He's on something called the Dutch Protocol, and it's a three-step walk to heaven. Here's how it works. Number one, they socially transition the child. They've already done that to my son. He's presented as a girl to the world when he's with his mother, although he's always a boy with me. Number two, they suppress puberty with extremely strong hormone drugs that castrate males, make them infertile, and halt the growth of their sexual organs. That can happen as early as 8 years old. My son's got about 2 years, and I'm struggling to make this practice illegal in the state of Texas.
Can you believe this? In the state of Texas, this is not New York, this is not California, this is the state of Texas. This is going on according to this father. Then he continues the story. This is Cut Three.
As early as 15, he could be surgically transitioned. He would be condemned to a life of banishment, despair, and up to, depending on the stats you look at, up to 60% of post-op transsexuals commit suicide. I resisted it with everything I had, all my money, all my time, everything. So she went to court. She filed a motion to effectively terminate my parental rights. Here's what she's asked the court to do. Jail me if I say James is a boy or present him as a boy to any of you. To jail me if I refuse to attend transgender ideology education classes or if I fail to satisfy the transgender instructor of that class. And I assure you, I would never satisfy such an instructor. Jail me if I use male pronouns for my son or allow others to do so. She also asked the court to jail me if I don't pay for all this, because currently in the state of Texas, that's all considered medical child support, and I'll go to prison for it.
Can you believe this? Can you believe this? So according to this father, his ex-wife wants him jailed for certain things that he is not cooperating with pertaining to transitioning his little boy to become, quote unquote, a little girl, which we all know is not even possible. Walt Heyer, whom I've interviewed on this show before, was dressed up in little purple dresses by his grandmother when he was little. It ended up completely messing with his head. He ended up going through full-blown sex change surgery and discovered later on he came to the Lord and said, wait a minute, I'm male, I'm not a girl, and transitioned back to the sex God made him to be. And he was actually the person who wrote the story about Sam, Jeff Younger, back at the Federalist in October, I believe it was, or November, perhaps it was, of last year, because he completely understands what it's like. He gets this issue. He went through this whole thing. Now, listen to this cut, the last cut I want to play for you. Jeff Younger talking about his current legal constraints in the case. This is cut four.
I'm currently under court orders, temporary orders, an injunction from the court that prevents me from presenting my son as a boy to anybody who's ever known him as a girl. They have also issued prior restraints on my parental speech. Everyone here should know prior restraints on speech are totally unconstitutional. The federal courts are virtually unanimous, going all the way back to founding this country on that. I cannot try to convince my son that he is a boy. Now that means I've been unable to teach him traditional Christian teachings on sexuality and gender, and I can't let him go to Sunday school because my church, pretty much like yours, we teach this as just men and women. Now they want to keep all this secret. They've tried to use gag orders on me. They've tried to seal the court records. They've enacted those prior restraints. Psychologists have threatened me with losing my child if I dare to go public with this and tell you my child's real name is James instead of Luna. But you need to know what's happening in the darkness. This is happening in family courts all over the state now. My son's just the tip of the spear. So we need to fight this. And they're coming for my son, that's for sure. It won't be long before they're coming for your children.
You know, it just strikes me, first of all, how sorry I feel for this father, spending all of this money and taking all of these actions to try to protect his son and keep his son a boy and deal with the aftermath of what has to be a very horrible situation with a divorce and custody and all the rest. Breaks my heart, though, that this is all happening. And where is the outrage from just normal people across this country? Of course, Christians would be upset by this. Of course, people who understand marriage and sexuality to be the way God designed it are going to be upset by this, of all stripes. You don't have to be a Christian to recognize there are two sexes, male and female. What's happening here, though, is the stuff of nightmares pertaining to these little kids. It really is the stuff of nightmares. How else can you explain it? How else can you describe it? They're now taking children, and it isn't just this case. It's cases all over the country. You have situations where you have little kids, and up to 98% of kids with gender confusion grow out of it. Do you know that? These statistics that we've seen, that we've talked about quite a few times on the show. And they're taking these kids and they're giving these strong hormones to these kids. They're socially transitioning them. They're medically transitioning them. And you have a clinic that actually does sex change operations on children. This is flat out evil. And what will come down the road when these kids grow up? When it turns out to be a disaster? What happens to little kids who are given hormone injections or pills or however they administer these things to these kids, and it sterilizes them, and they grow up and then they can't have children of their own, but they've decided the sex that they were forced to be was not their sex to begin with, and they objected to the entire thing, and then they turn and they sue the people who tried to put them through it all, the doctors and the hospitals and the clinics, maybe even the parents or the grandparents who are pushing for this sort of thing. This is a legal nightmare to come, not to mention just a mess when it comes to human loss and human pain and human tragedy. And you can see it from a distance. And what's going to happen? We just need to be aware of this, and custody being lost and custody being threatened over gender transitioning, when we all know that you cannot transition from one sex to another. It's a matter of confusion. This is just so serious. And my heart just really goes out to this family and all the families who are going through similar situations. It's heartbreaking and excruciating to listen to this. We're going to come back on Janet Mefford Today. More to come. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Kirk Cameron, and I am honored to be partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to help moms choose life.
Actor Kirk Cameron supports Preborn.
My four oldest children were adopted. That is because of caring and compassionate people who help those young mothers choose life. My wife is an adopted child, and her birth mother chose life for her. If it weren't for those caring individuals that help those young moms value the sacredness of life, I wouldn't have my wife, I wouldn't have my four adopted children, and the two natural-born children that we have wouldn't exist either. My whole family is here because of people that are involved with ministries like Preborn.
Preborn funds pregnancy centers across the nation so they can offer free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. Ultrasound is a game changer because when abortion-minded women actually see their babies in their wombs for themselves, 80% of the time, they choose life. Would you please join us at Janet Mefford today to support the Ministry of Preborn? For $140, you can provide five free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. A gift of $22 will provide one ultrasound, and every gift helps. To donate, please call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your gift goes directly towards saving babies. Think of the children in the womb this January. You can get involved, and you can help save a life for a gift of $140. Five free ultrasounds will be offered to women in crisis pregnancies. Please call now with your gift, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY. 855-402-2229, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. This is just incredible. Did you hear about this one? Officials with the California Department of Veterans Affairs are threatening to evict an 84-year-old widow from the California Veterans Home unless she stops leading longtime Bible studies that she's been holding for fellow residents. Unfortunately, these things happen too often these days. We're going to get all the details now from Brad Dacus, president of Pacific Justice Institute. Brad, so good to talk to you again. How are you?
Oh, doing just great. Thank you.
Well, this is a terrible story. It just makes me sick to read about this and to see what's going on in California. Can you tell us a little bit about this widow and what's going on?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, this widow, you know, she's a wonderful lady. She's 84 years old. Her name is Artis Bro. And she has, you know, come under attack. She's been working as a volunteer chaplain there for about 10 years in this California veterans home, and her and her husband were both there. They were both veterans, and he passed away. He worked was a merchant marine in World War II and the Korean War. You know, she herself has served as a civilian employee with the Office of the Chief of Staff of the Army and the Pentagon during the Korean War. They've served their country. He passed away, but she served her country faithfully to defending freedom and our liberty. And then she was removed from the chaplaincy program last September when it was claimed that a discussion between her and another resident about heaven and hell and the hereafter caused him to lose some sleep and therefore was elder abuse and emotional abuse.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So then there was no investigation. You know, there's supposedly investigation, but they never talked to her. Then she was removed from the program, chaplaincy program. Well, then recently, on March 1st, we received an alarming email from her attorney claiming that her Bible studies that she was continuing to have were in violation of the prior directives, and that if she did not cease and desist having Bible studies with voluntary participants there in the nursing home, then she would be evicted and thrust out on the streets.
Good grief. Wait,
yeah.
So now she was accused of elder abuse and emotional abuse because another resident lost some sleep because of a biblical discussion. I mean, how does that rise to the level of elder abuse? Elder abuse, I always think of some, you know, worker in a nursing home who hits a resident or, you know, does something nefarious physically to a resident. How in the world does that rise to the level of elder abuse?
Yeah, it really doesn't. And, you know, the fact that one person in a voluntary discussion disagreed with her and her sharing the gospel message should not force to put someone in a position to not to be able to share their faith again, much less have a Bible study, and then be evicted and kicked out on the street if she ever was caught sharing or having the Bible study with anyone. I think that is, outrageous, exclamation mark. We at Pacific Justice Institute, we sent a strongly worded response to the state on about a week ago, or it was last Friday, and we're weighing all of our legal options in representing her in this matter. Hopefully, we'll see them, they'll back down, but this is very disturbing, and for people like her, who's done so much and has served so much, her and her husband, and to receive this kind of treatment is it should really be an alarm for everyone.
Yeah. Now, you had said, I know in your press release about this, that CalVet did not schedule an interview with Artis after this, you know, an ongoing investigation into her alleged elder abuse. Did CalVet ever follow up on that? Did she ever meet with them and discuss what happened and kind of get into the details on that?
No, they never met with her. And that's what's really unusual also. When you have an investigation, you're going to at least talk to the person who was allegedly had done something.
Right.
But they didn't. They never talked to her, never listened to her. They just wanted to shut her down and not allow her to have Bible studies. You know, this is a concern also as far as the military chaplaincy program. We saw it really a lot of pressure the last, about 10 years ago is when it started. Where chaplains were being limited, they can't share the gospel. They just got to be sort of generic about a generic God. And that has put pressure on people in the past in the chaplaincies. This is really taking it to a new level when we're talking about saying, okay, not only can you not be a chaplain, but we're going to actually boot you out and evict you if you're caught in your own capacity having a Bible study with people who want to share the word with you.
Good grief. Well, and she had received permission, hadn't she, to continue to do those Bible studies. So are they wrong in saying that she was violating a directive to stop the Bible studies?
Yeah, they were, because she was, you know, engaging in a Bible study. Any resident should be able to meet with other people and study the Bible. It was totally voluntary. It wasn't an official capacity as a chaplain. And she wasn't, identifying herself as a chaplain, wasn't wearing a chaplain uniform, nothing like that. She's actually a resident of this facility. She's 84 years old. Mm. And it's just, when I think about harm and abuse, I'm just sort of thinking about what toll is this taking on her?
Yeah.
At her age, to be told you have to stop sharing from the Bible or we're going to put you out in the street.
Yeah.
That's really, disturbing from a constitutional perspective, as well as from a public policy and humanity perspective as well.
Well, that's right. And I understand that she thinks the real issue is that she's an evangelical Jewish believer in Jesus, which she claims doesn't sit well with some of the chaplains. What's the angle on that, Brad?
Yeah, that goes, it goes back to what we're seeing happening with regards to chaplaincies and those directing chaplaincy programs, being encouraged to, I say, be spiritually negligent. And I sort of spiritually, I call it negligent, but spiritually sort of generic.
Yeah.
And when you have someone who is a strong Christian, and of course, who used to be Jewish and now they're Christian, they have very strong Christian beliefs, and there's a real bias that we see taking place in the military chaplaincy programs. From the top down. This started about 10 years ago, about 2008. There was a shift. I don't want to link it to politics for the program purposes, but it clearly started at that time, and I think this could be just part of that rippling effect of what we're seeing. She's very sincere in her faith, and that's a good thing. Chaplains need to be respectful of other people who have different faiths. That's not a problem with her at all. They're asking her, though, to muzzle her faith and talk about the lilies of the field and not to really get into what people really want in Bible study, which is a deeper, real relationship with God.
Wow. What's the point otherwise? I mean, whatever happened to the fact that the federal government is not allowed to infringe upon the free exercise of religion? Whatever happened to that? I mean, right. It seems like we're losing that more and more every day. You can't prohibit the free exercise of religion. And for Christians, the free exercise of religion includes studying the Bible and talking about things like heaven and hell. What business is it of the states to intervene and tell this woman that she can't do this?
Yeah, we're looking at two parts of the First Amendment being violated here. One is, of course, the free exercise of religion. And the other one is the Establishment Clause, state hostility to religion and people who are of a faith and possibly booting them out because of their sharing their faith. So, but you're absolutely right. Now, the good news is that because the Supreme Court and our federal courts have made some moves in the right direction during the last 2 years, this Supreme Court is one that looks like they may be willing to really firm up the free exercise protections through new case law and go back to how it was originally intended, which was for the government not to infringe upon this. And I won't get too much of the details of the standards that they're looking at based on a recent case. They're entertaining the prospect of a much more strict standard protecting the free exercise of religion. We may have a Supreme Court that it will be the most pro-religious freedom in our nation's history, actually. So we're looking forward to moving ahead with this and other cases like this at the Pacific Justice Institute.
That's great. What are artists' options if they actually go ahead and kick her out of the California Veterans Home? I mean, that can't be good PR for them at the very least. That's the least of the issue. But that can't be good PR for them to kick an 84-year-old woman with, you know, a veteran for a husband. I mean, that would look horrible on them in addition to being evil.
Yeah, it would. It'd be terrible public relations. Sometimes bureaucrats don't really think that through. They're not like a private business where customers, you know, can do business elsewhere.
Right.
But nonetheless, I think that it would be a PR disaster. And I think that there would be a lot of people who are going to take alarm to that, and I think it would have some repercussions.
Very good. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Brad Dacus from Pacific Justice Institute. Thanks a lot, Brad. Thanks for joining us on Janet Mefford today. We'll see you next time.